The gospel reading is from the book of John, chapter 11, verses 1 through 45. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent a message to Jesus, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sisters and Lazarus, after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you, and you are going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Those who walk during the day do not stumble because they see the light of this world. But those who walk at night stumble because the light is not in them." After saying this, he told them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will be all right." Jesus, however, had been speaking about his death, and they thought that he was referring merely to sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. For your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world." When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in her house, consoling her, saw Mary get up and quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus again, greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, already there is a stench because he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, "Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me."
Sometimes our culture calls us to live in ways that don't actually work very well. And a good example of this is the pressure to be a good multitasker. And, you know, a basic fact about modern life is that for most of us, we feel like life is extremely busy and complex. And it feels like there are multiple things calling for 110% of our attention. Our families demand attention, our jobs demand attention, our education demand attention, sports programs demand attention, for young people, social media demands attention, home improvements demand attention, health issues might demand our attention. If you're into this kind of thing, the latest season of Game of Thrones might demand your attention. And so what's the solution to a world that asks us to juggle a million responsibilities at the same time? Well, multitasking. Learn to focus on lots of things simultaneously. That's kind of the new expectation that we're all expected to be good at and do, and you know, just do everything well at the same time. Well, here's the thing I was hearing about lately. Even though a lot of us fool ourselves into thinking that we can focus on two or three or even four things at the same time, scientists who actually study the brain have found that in most cases, multitasking is a delusion. As we try to juggle these lots of things at the same time, it often feels to us like we are multitasking. That's the story we tell ourselves. But scientists who study the brain find that actually what happens in people when they're juggling lots of things is that their attention is rapidly shifting from one thing to the next, but not necessarily paying attention to everything at once. One researcher says, "Think about writing an email and talking on the phone at the same time. Those things are nearly impossible to do at the same time. You cannot focus on one while doing the other." When I read this quote, I immediately recognized my own experience here. Especially, you know, there have been times, say, my wife is talking to me and I certainly want to listen, but I fool myself into thinking that I can multitask while I listen. So especially with technology, you know, here I'm watching a show, kind of, and listening, kind of, and or maybe on my computer, kind of, and listening, kind of. And so she's talking to me, and I'm like, yeah, I'm listening, yeah. And then I look down, and I'm doing whatever I'm doing, and I don't know how much time passes. And suddenly I look up, and I realize I have no idea what she's been saying for who knows how long. And what's worse, she knows I have no idea what she's saying, too. So multitasking is hard. This is maybe one of the reasons that faith can be hard too, because there are times when walking in the truth or when living the faith in a mature way means doing two things at the same time or holding two ideas in our head at the same time, and that's not easy. You know, with the ideas thing, we like to think in either or terms. Is it this or is it that? We like to think in black or white, one at a time. A good example of this dynamic can be found in the experience of death and grief, right? We can ask the question, how are Christians supposed to respond to death and to loss and to difficulties? How are Christians supposed to respond to these things and grieve? Now, we might say that there's no one answer to how Christians are supposed to grieve because, of course, you can't tell someone else how to grieve. And this is certainly true. When death shows up, when loss shows up, you can't tell someone how they should grieve. It just kind of happens more than something we choose. So that's true. But at the same time, the way that we respond to loss, the way that we grieve, has a lot to do with how we understand God, how we understand life, and how we understand the gospel. You know, specifically when it comes to grief, I think among Christians, there are two main schools of thought about how we should grieve. On the one hand, you have the optimists who want to emphasize hope, but who kind of sometimes want to avoid grief. These are the kinds who say that funerals shouldn't be times of mourning, they should be celebrations of life. Because, hey, we have Easter, we have the resurrection, so why should we be sad? We know that God will give them to us again. And among the real kind of extreme people of this perspective, sorrow and grief can almost be seen as a flaw in people of faith because it's interpreted as if you must not believe if you're sad when your loved one dies. So that's one perspective. On the other side, we have the grieving people, the people who want to validate grief and not turn too quickly to hope without going through grief. And these types of people want to say that it's, of course, fine to acknowledge loss and grief because these feelings are natural and necessary and healthy. And by the way, I agree with that. I think we do need to validate grief. But I've actually met some people who are so extreme in the idea that we need to validate our grief that they could almost wallow in it, that there almost becomes this idea that if you hope, if you find hope in the gospel, that you're somehow undercutting grief, that you can only do grief and you can't do hope. So which school of thought is right? Should Christians feel hopeful in the midst of death, Or should we feel loss and grief and sorrow in the midst of death and loss? Well, I think the story that we heard today of Lazarus gives us a chance to at least look at Jesus and look at how he responded to death and loss. One of the background facts of this story that John, the gospel author, wants to emphasize again and again is that Lazarus isn't just a stranger. Lazarus is a friend of Jesus, right? Lazarus is part of this little family unit we hear about, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. They show up again and again in the gospel of John. And it's apparent again that in these stories, Jesus is very close to this family. In this story, Lazarus is referred to as he whom Jesus loves. I don't know why this is surprising. Sometimes I've been surprised that Jesus would have friends. Maybe, you know, sometimes we have this idea of an impersonal, mighty God out there. But Jesus was someone who had friends. So he was close to Lazarus and his family. So anyways, in this story, Jesus receives word that his dear friend Lazarus is desperately ill. And so how does Jesus respond to this news? Well, he doesn't respond with worry or with wanting to rush in. He responds with total calm and confidence. And specifically, he says, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." And he goes on to explain that, the story goes on to explain that, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, he stayed where he was 2 days longer. So he didn't go and rush to help and heal Lazarus. He stayed where he was, which is kind of a weird thing if he loves him so much. And based on this picture, it would seem that Jesus has zero anxiety, zero emotion about the fear of his dear friend's death, because apparently he just trusts in God's power so much that, you know, there's just not a worry in Jesus. Well, then we skip ahead, and Jesus receives word from someone in this village that Lazarus has, in fact, died of his illness. And so he heads to Bethany, where Lazarus was staying with his family, and here comes Martha, one of Lazarus's sisters, and you could almost hear the accusation in her voice, an accusation I think we often feel in the midst of death, where Martha says to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And then we get this curious scene, which is very different from the first part, where Jesus is surrounded by the reality of death. And he sees his friends Martha and Mary deep in weeping, and he sees this whole town, this whole village weeping. And I don't know if you've ever been in this, where you either yourself or see a family who are going through mourning, and it's not just something they're going through. I mean, you could feel it among people who've lost someone that they love. And it says that Jesus is so taken up in this scene that it says he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. And Jesus says, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." And then we get the shortest verse in the whole Bible, but apparently it was important, even though it was short. Jesus, it says, began to weep. And the Jews say, "See how much he loved him." I'm sure you'll notice that this is a completely different picture of Jesus than the one we encounter earlier, than the confident, unconcerned, optimistic Jesus who just doesn't have any emotion or fear or sense of loss around death. This is a Jesus who's totally moved by the reality of loss in the midst of death. And this is a Jesus who weeps because he sees his friends weeping and who weeps because his friend has died. And of course, we know in this story that before long, Jesus is going to undo death. Jesus is going to raise Lazarus back to life. And I suppose Jesus knew this too. And yet, I think it's important. He still weeps. So what does this all mean? I suppose it means different things to different people. For me, it means that Jesus invites us to do something that's pretty hard when we experience loss. He invites us to multitask in our experience of what death and loss means to us as Christian people. And he invites us to see that our hope in the gospel does not need to cancel out our experience of grief, right? It doesn't do that. And yet also, our experience of grief does not cancel out the power of the gospel to speak hope into our lives. We see in Jesus that grief and hope live together in the same person, just like God's spirit and humanity live together in the same person in Jesus Christ. So at the end of the day, even though no one could tell you how to experience loss, I think this story invites us into a way of experiencing death and loss, and into a way of thinking and acting when these things show up. This story tells us that it's totally normal and healthy and necessary to grieve when we lose someone we love. What else would we do? I mean, if you love someone and you have to say goodbye to for now, how could you not be moved into sorrow? But the story also reminds us that Jesus does have power over death. We might be waiting to see it, but Jesus does have the power. That's one of the things that's being demonstrated here. And so as we weep, just like these families wept for Lazarus's death, that's great, that's okay that we're weeping, but they don't need to be tears of despair. They can be tears of faith, hope, and love. They can be tears that know sorrow, but that also can see beyond the sorrow into the resurrection. And I truly believe that when we start to see this resurrection, maybe it's something we're not totally seeing yet, but we start to see it in our faith, this is when transformation can begin in our loss. This is when light can be seen even in the midst of darkness. This is when hope can be experienced even in the midst of despair. And this is when we can even see life in the midst of death. Thanks be to God for that. Amen.